Welcome to Service and Wealth, the podcast dedicated to helping military personnel master their finances and achieve financial freedom. Our mission is to guide you through the ins and outs of planning, saving, and investing, and most importantly, how to balance savings so you can enjoy life now and retire with confidence. All right. Hey, welcome back. We're here with another episode of the Service and Wealth podcast here in season two. Today, we're here with Ensign Tebow. And this is another young officer who I happen to know from my time at the Naval Academy. So what I want to first and foremost do is welcome him to the show. Is it okay if we call you Max?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
Happy to be here.
You know, well, thanks for taking the time. Max actually is out there in Norfolk, Virginia, and he just got off ship from, what was it, 2 months?
Two months.
Or thereabouts. Right. So what was the first thing he thought he should do when he came ashore? Obviously, jump on a video interview here with me and record this. No, actually, he's definitely taken some time for his family and some other things to get his feet dry again. But you know, for me, Max he was a student I had at the Naval Academy. He's originally from upstate New York, small town, I believe, kind of out in like the Finger Lakes region. And he, at the Naval Academy, he was an engineering student. Was it aeronautical engineering? Is that right?
Yeah, I studied aerospace, but I was like more specialized into astronautics.
Astronautics. Okay. So that's like rocket science and going to the moon, right?
Yeah, satellites, that sort of thing.
Okay. Just simple, mundane things that everybody can tackle. Well, so Max, and one of the reasons why I have him here on the show is he and his wife, Emma, moved down to Virginia Beach, and straight away out of his schooling, they became homeowners, and they didn't just do the typical thing. They bought a house that they knew they were going to fix up and add value to. And so I was really excited to hear about that, and also eager to share with the community some of the lessons he's learned in that experience. But another reason why I'm really excited to have Max on the show is because of the presence that Max had and the mind he has, but the presence he had in my classroom. And, you know, when I think back to that time teaching at the academy, I think about the different kind of students you had. And there were a couple football players who always sat in the back. And when their eyes got really heavy, I knew I needed to like kind of like spice things up and try to throw in a joke. Not saying I had anything that was funny, but I was like, okay, you got to bring the energy up. And then with Max, he was a guy who I could kind of check out of the corner of my eye because I knew he was tracking everything. And he was kind of like checking my work as I went and, you know, really applying like, you know, his smarts to it. And if I saw a look on his face that was kind of like, you know, I'm not sure that's exactly right, I knew that I had to come back, that I had done a good job in teaching. So, you know, I think talking to him is going to be great because he's going to offer some great insights and great perspectives on things. And, you know, I think I might be wrong, but I feel like we'll have, you know, maybe some different takes on something. And that's always the most fun part of having a conversation because, you know, why talk to somebody if you just are going to agree with them the whole time? Max, is there anything else that you'd like to share? You know, I tried to do like a real quick bio. I don't know if you want to tell us anything more about your career or where you are in life.
No, yeah. I appreciate the kind words. I will say, like, especially going back to thinking back to the classroom time, like, I always try to be very intentional about everything that I do. It's like, it's nice to kind of reminisce on like the times in class where maybe I was coming off as intense, but I was just trying to, you know, study up and pay attention. So yeah, as far as career wise, right now I'm a surface warfare officer. I'm a nuclear designator. So in the next couple of years here, I'll be going to Charleston and getting my nuclear qualification to go serve on a carrier afterward. But yeah, that's pretty much it for me. I've been in the military for about 1 year now, so I'm still kind of getting the hang of the professional aspect, but I'm trying to take it all roll with the punches here, you know, take it all one step at a time.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely sounds like the, you know, kind of standard experience, I guess, for the first couple of years of being in the military, especially being an officer where there's a bit higher bar in terms of expectations. Are you enjoying your career and where you are so far?
Yeah, I would say so. It's definitely not something I see myself doing long term, just because I've got different ambitions in life. Like I see the people who are at the end of their career, like my captain, for example. Like, you know, he's had 20 years in. He's at the height of his career. He's probably gonna be an admiral after this. And I'm just thinking, like, you know, like that's great. I love the ambition for that, pursuing the military excellence. But like for me, like I'm more interested in like working on my family. I'm interested in retiring early, and the whole like fire movement sort of thing. So like to me, like doing that 20, 30-year career just isn't really in the picture. But that being said, like I like to kind of take it all in the moment. So while I'm here, you know, I might as well do the best that I can.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's obviously sort of the expectation, and that's what your peers and your sailors deserve. But that's also just part of the, I think, the ethos that you have in life in general, you know, pushing yourself and wanting to do great things. So I definitely respect that and appreciate that. You know, one of the things, the questions that I try to throw in at the beginning, because it's, you know, we're a military community and the name of the podcast is Service and Wealth. And so we're not just talking money. I always like to ask sort of your why, like what led you to this path, you know, maybe first of seeking and accepting a commissioning through the Naval Academy, or I should say an appointment at the Naval Academy and then commissioning there and then wanting to be a naval officer.
Yeah, so originally, all I wanted to do was fly airplanes. I thought I was going to be like Tom Cruise, just like I'm sure a lot of people do when they first join the military. You know, I started like taking pilot's lessons when I was like 14 years old, like getting my civilian qualification, kind of like working my way up to that point. Obviously, things didn't pan out exactly how I had planned. I mean, I'd say I'm thankful for where I ended up. I think it's kind of a interesting sort of mental shock to have to pivot your career plan on a dime, but it kind of keeps you adaptable and it kind of teaches you to like accept where you're, what you're given in life and kind of do make the most out of it. So yeah, that's like originally why I joined. Obviously, I also appreciate the leadership aspect of it. And like just going through the academy, all the stuff that they taught me there, that's like really incredible information that I couldn't have gotten anywhere else. I would say like the military discipline, the character, the leadership, that really was attractive to me when I was doing my initial research. And at the end of the day, like I just love doing like hard things and kind of challenging myself. So going to the Naval Academy specifically was it was a big hurdle just to get in, let alone to make it through. And then beyond that, like just kind of like embracing the leadership aspect. Like now that I'm in, I've got people who I'm in charge of who rely on me to do my job. So it's a lot of responsibility, but I really like the experience.
Well, thanks for sharing that. You know, I had to smile when you talk about coming in and expecting to be an aviator. When I came home and announced to my parents that I had signed a contract to go to officer candidate school to become a Marine officer, they said, "Well, what are you going to do?" And I said, "If things work out, I hope to fly A-10 Warthogs." Right? And, you know, I
Yeah,
never
it's the
actually did the
dream.
research to find out that the Marine Corps doesn't have those, or that I had signed a ground contract and not a flight contract. But we all, you know, we all have these experiences. And then just as you said, we come out the other way. And, you know, gosh, I got to say, looking back, if everything had lined up and gone as I had expected, I'd probably be like a much more fragile person. Have you been able to reflect on your time so far from being a midshipman as well as this first year in your fleet and kind of see how some of those experiences might have translated over into, for example, this early start into real estate that you and your wife have made?
100%. I would say specifically, like a real pivotal moment was when I actually found out that I wasn't going to be flying and that I got kind of like selected for this nuclear thing that I wasn't really 100% like familiar with. I kind of like recalibrated like what I wanted to do with my life, because like before that I was just like, you know, I'm just going to fly airplanes for 20 years. Like it's pretty obvious. But now I've got this kind of alternate goal where like I don't necessarily have to work for 20 years. I could maybe use my knowledge and the stuff that I've learned so far to sort of do a unconventional thing, which is, pursue this sort of aggressive investment and saving goal to get me more time with my family, which is ultimately what I really enjoy doing, is like spending time with my family. And at some point here, I'll plan on having kids, and I need, like, I feel like I want to actually be there for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think where you are is fantastic because I and like so many who kind of start out on a little bit more of the, yes or no, ma'am, like following the same kind of path that we see amongst the senior officers, the ones who are going through to 20 and then it becomes 25 and they keep going, is you never really kind of like identify that why for yourself or that mission that you have for yourself. And what's really important, you're sort of like all in, and then suddenly the family and the kids are there, and you've done nothing to prepare yourself financially to even have the choice. And so to hear you say that you've already gotten to that position where you're like, I know in the future this is what I want, and I'm going to work for it now, is really inspiring. Was that something that you've always felt? Was that something that you kind of, went through a deliberate process of identifying your goals and painting this picture of the life you wanted? Is that something you had coming into your marriage with Emma, or was that something you worked together? A lot of questions there.
Yeah, I would say so. Like, first thing I would like to say, like, it's kind of something I always was aware of. Like, being in the military is hard on your life. Like, it demands a lot out of you. I knew that signing up. I will say it's interesting to see how that affects different people. For example, like, I know people who are warrant officers who've been in for 20 plus years, and they don't really have a choice to retire because they haven't planned well enough to sort of leave the military like gracefully, and so they're kind of stuck. Like I was just talking to this guy the other day, and he was saying about how, he's missing his kids' baseball games and, yada yada yada, and he just has to keep going because, like, he doesn't really have a choice. I mean, so I knew that there had to be a better way. There's got to be some way to kind of like have the best of both worlds almost, because, like, you hear it all the time. Like, I feel like we always see, like, commanders and stuff, people who are COs who, yeah, they might have this illustrious career, but then you, like, take a look at their family life and they're like, their kids don't love them, like, their marriage is in shambles. It happens way too often. And I feel like having, like, a financial security blanket helps a lot, because, like, even if you do enjoy the military and you want to, like, keep going for, 30 years or whatever it is, like, having that option to be like, to step away and change your mind is super powerful, in my opinion.
Yeah,
Sorry, so what
absolutely.
else, what other questions did you have?
Oh
Lost
yeah.
track.
Sorry, I there was a little bit of a cascade there. I got excited. And thank you for that first part of the response. The other was if this was something that you had sat down and you read a book and did this goal setting. Is it something you did with your wife? Is it like is I got to imagine you're both on the same page with that, but I'm just curious if that was like part of your relationship building or something that you kind of did on your own.
Yeah. So kind of going into, like, my career, I didn't really have any financial education or anything. I'm like, growing up, my mother was, it's like, a single mother. She was a barber my entire life. So we were definitely like a lower income household, just like many Americans, many military service members. And it was definitely like, we weren't bad in a bad position. My mother thankfully didn't teach me any bad habits, so that I have to be absolutely thankful for. Like, we were never going to, like, payday loan shops or anything like that. But I mean, that being said, like, it was always cash savings, kind of just like never spending more than we made, but never really like having enough to save for the future or do any sort of financial planning. Like, my education growing up kind of stopped at, like, don't spend everything on a credit card, and, like, which for most people, that's even that's a, like, a revelation. But like, I would say, like, my real financial education kind of started once I got to, like, college, and once I started kind of thinking about how the money plays into life. Because, like, basically at the academy, the first year they do, like, this little 1 week financial education class, I guess, and I started learning about like investing and compound interest and how you can basically use your money to make more money, and then that money makes even more money after that. And it's just like being like someone with a strong math background, that just made so much sense to me right off the bat. And it just didn't click to me before, like that you could actually do this with money. So that was kind of eye-opening for me. And sort of from that point, I started really getting into stocks and investing in like just like basic like mutual funds, index funds, that sort of thing. So I had basically been doing that for the entire time I was at school. And then I took your class where you introduced us to the idea of real estate investing. And to me, that was kind of like a foreign topic for a while. Like I knew that it was kind of there, but I wasn't really super interested in it because it seemed like a lot of work and a lot of like stuff that I would have to learn. But I would say that, like, once again, that kind of pivotal point when I like had a change in my sort of job path, it kind of led me to be like, okay, I'm doing this new career. May not be what I wanted to do, but how can I kind of transform this into a good thing? So part of that was getting a nuke bonus, because you get a sign-on bonus when you become a nuke. And so I was like, maybe I could put this to good use. And I had started learning about real estate from what you had talked to me. And so after that point, I really started going into like heavy with the research. I was doing like basically just watching podcasts, doing like reading articles, doing like all this research for basically a year after that, just kind of really getting my hands dirty with that stuff. And I feel like that was really the main driving force for me to like start pursuing this. And then my wife, well, let me just say, like, I've been with my wife for a long time. Like, we were high school sweethearts, which is pretty unique, I would say, in this time, just because like most people, I feel like, rarely make it past college. And now we're married, and it's great. I feel like it's like a life hack to have like two incomes in one household. It's awesome. But like, so I've been talking to her this whole time, right? But it's kind of like one of those things where we have a very typical relationship, like my wife and I. I would say this happens a lot, at least from what I've heard with people. Like one person kind of is really into like the numbers and like crunching and like doing simulations and stuff, and the other one's just kind of like, okay, sure, that sounds good. That's very much how it is with me and my wife. She's obviously very supportive, which is the biggest thing. And then I kind of get to do like all the numbers and all the spreadsheets and stuff, which is fun to me. So we're just kind of like playing off our strengths, just like anything with marriage.
Well, that's, that there's so many like sort of like hidden valuable lessons to share within everything you just said, but I think it's important to capture sort of what you just wrapped up with, which is playing to your strengths in a relationship. And that I think it would be much a weaker strategy or effort if you're both, trying to take charge and do the same thing, and it would probably hold you up from actually taking action. And for all this time that you spent, which, again, kudos to you for really putting in the hard work, especially on top of the academic load at the Naval Academy to be pursuing that additional kind of education. But, at some point you had to take action, right? And so can we maybe just, of all the different things that I want to talk with you about today, could we maybe take a moment just to look back at how you went from spending all this time reading and studying, going from interest to, maybe a level of comfort, if not confidence, but like, and then transitioning from that into like, let's just go out and do it.
Yeah, of course. I would say like I said, initially I had no real interest in real estate just because it was kind of on my peripheral and I wasn't really thinking that it was worth my time. Or not necessarily that, but it seemed like it was worth a it required a lot of time and I didn't necessarily have the time to get into that. But it kind of started like I was just like listening to some podcasts, just some average, real estate investing podcasts, and I started like reading a book about it, like listening to an audiobook. I really started like thinking like there's something here. Like I feel like I'm very much a numbers guy, and so when I realized that you could make much better returns and still be consistent in real estate, that kind of really piqued my interest because like. And it's not just a small difference. Like we're talking 10% average yearly return in stocks, whereas in real estate, you might get 20 plus if you do it right. So that kind of really got me motivated to kind of start pursuing it a little bit more, especially after I started digging a little bit deeper and I learned that it doesn't really require that much time, not as much as I was expecting. So, like, as far as confidence goes, I would say just kind of like doing that year of research. Like, I'm not saying you'd need a year of research. I just had a year because it took me a year to actually graduate and do all the stuff that I needed to do before I
And
was
have
ready
some
to
money.
actually buy a house. Right. But it definitely helped a lot, 'cause like I started learning like this doesn't seem that hard. And like, especially, it's really eye-opening when you are like listening to these people talk about something and you realize that you know more than they do and they're doing it, and you're like, okay, I could probably do this. So yeah, I would say that. I also had a little bit of background. Like, my grandparents do have a real estate business. Their strategy is very like just live in flips, then they do like some rentals here and there. Growing up, that didn't really I didn't pay attention to that at all. So I wouldn't say it was like a driving factor in me getting into this. It was kind of after the fact that I learned, like, oh, this is what my grandparents are doing. But yeah, I didn't they didn't never really they never really gave me like a ton of like advice on that front, especially because like the time that they were doing it was a very different real estate market, so it's not really something that I could replicate easily. But I did spend like a couple summers like just with them, like working on a house or whatever. I'm doing some basic like contractor work, and making a little money on the side, and it kind of like gave me that confidence to be like, you know, working on a house isn't really as scary as some people think it is. So that kind of started to help drive my strategy and kind of thinking what I might want to pursue from a real estate strategy perspective. And yeah, I would say another confidence piece was like after I did graduate, I did have that bonus, so I had like enough for like a down payment if I needed one, right? Obviously, VA loan aside, but I was like starting to think like, okay, this is starting to get serious. I can probably start doing like some more research on the specific market that I'm going to be in. And so like even before I graduated, I had intentionally chose orders to Norfolk, Virginia Beach, because I knew that the market was at a price point that I could stomach compared to somewhere like San Diego. So intentionally I went here. I started researching Virginia Beach, Norfolk, like Hampton Roads area. I'm trying to find like all the good spots, the bad spots, sort of like getting a brief insight on trends. I'm not super big on following trends, but I kind of like started looking into the market and gaining my familiarity with it. And then the last kind of confidence booster was actually finding an agent and like starting to get the ball rolling with that. I feel like once you have a good agent, a lot of stuff starts kind of fall together. I won't get into it too much, but I did have a agent initially who I had to fire because he just wasn't really giving me what I needed. And to take a little bit of ownership too, I didn't actually have my plan, like my strategy, fully outlined yet. So we were working together, but we weren't really working together. You know what I mean? I mean, it
Yeah,
wasn't
absolutely.
giving us the right result. So anyway, I ended up finding a new agent who was a lot more like real estate investor focused. And him, like just having him on the team, like helped so much. And especially having his recommendations and the access to his network, which if you don't already know, like that's like obviously like the one of the biggest benefits of being a real estate agent is your network. Like they say, there's like a saying, like your network is your net worth. I feel like that mostly comes from like real estate agents because they're in the business every single day. So it helps a lot. So yeah, a lot of kind of like stepping stones and building blocks that kind of worked me up in terms of confidence. And then at the end of the day, like I had to move out of my apartment into a house, and I had already told myself like once my lease is up, I'm moving into a house. You know, once there's a time deadline, you kind of have to make something happen.
It's the famous sort of military stratagem of burning the ships, letting the troops know there's no place to go home to, so you might as well just go ashore and start fighting the fight. I actually do want to talk a little bit more, and it doesn't have to be more in terms of like a lot of minutes, but with your agent process, and that was something that you and I started talking about. It's been, wow, I almost a year ago, maybe, right? Is that about? I feel like it was about a year ago when you're going through this process. Time flies, right? But I remember talking to you about that and just trying to like reassure you that like Yes, it is totally normal. Like you have every right, and this is really important for the audience, especially anybody who's thinking of kind of going the route you're doing. You're hiring this person. They work for you, you know, and if they're not meeting your needs, there's no contract or obligation once you first get that agent through Zillow or, you know, somebody at their squadron like recommends you like, hey, this person helped us buy a house. And if they don't fit for you, just move on. It's not going to hurt their feelings, right? They're not going to like not help you if you came back later. And so I think that's a great example you set of having, and like you said, you didn't come into it with like everything sorted, but a good agent would have asked you the right questions to help you confirm that strategy. And, you know, it's sort of like one of those red flags that we can share for the audience is when you finally do get ready to go buy a house, whether it's for yourself or an investment property, if the agent's not asking you questions to understand you, and they're not kind of challenging what you're saying about what you're looking for, saying something like, well, that's not going to work in this neighborhood, but if you go this street, that could work. Those are red flags that this person is, they're not really in it for you, right? And so
yeah,
ultimately you found this person who had a good network, and I guess they found you a property that fit your strategy, which is sort of the live and flip strategy. Is that correct?
Yeah. And for the record, before we move on, I just want to say that my first agent, there was nothing necessarily wrong with him. Like I would say we still have a pretty good relationship. In fact, he even recommended me my second agent, the one that ended up working out. So like, definitely don't be afraid to like kind of strike out on your first agent, especially if you know that they're kind of like new. If you find out that they're kind of like new to the game, they're not exactly what you were expecting, then it's always like, it's a hard conversation to have, but it's easy to just be like, hey, you know, I don't think it's going to work out. We're going to have to find somebody else, but I appreciate like all the help. But yeah, we ended up having the second agent. We looked at a few houses. We ended up showing two, and we picked one of those two, like after literally 1 week of having this new agent. I think most of that was because I had this new like strategy kind of like fleshed out, because I had worked with that previous guy. I don't think it would have gone as flawlessly if I had just gone to this second guy initially. Once I had the strategy, like once you have your strategy outlined, it's super easy for real estate agents to just be like, okay, your strategy is this. Here's like X amount of properties that fit your strategy. Let's go see them and figure out something out.
Yeah. And that's, you know, on the one hand, you have just sort of like being a professional and being tactful, and obviously the way, even if that first agent didn't work out for you, it wasn't like you told him to pound sand, right? It was a professional, because you never know when that relationship will pay off, to your comment earlier about the network. And then it's also a really good example of how, when you go through this process of getting into investing and especially real estate, there's sort of like, you don't have to find a formal mentor, like somebody who you're calling up or chatting with. There's little bits of mentorship that you can grasp in every relationship as you go forward. And when you look at it, aside from the two agents that you worked with in this, how is it working with other parts of what I like to call like your team, right? Like, because ultimately they're trying to help you get the deal, close the deal, and move forward with the project. So, you know, were there any things that you found notable or worth talking about with, for example, I mean, you don't have to even really have like talk to them, but like talking about the negotiation process with the seller, anything with the bank or the loan officer, working with the general contractor who did the rehab with you guys. You want to talk about any sort of experiences you had with those people and those players along the way?
Yeah, for sure. It's like, to me, it's kind of like, especially with the sort of like value add sort of real estate investment, it's like you have your agent, your financer, and then like your contractors. To me, my agent gave me the contractor reference. So those were kind of together. And my first agent hooked me up with the lender that I ended up using. I would say, like, reflecting, I would definitely have looked around a little bit more for lenders. Not that there was anything wrong with the one I got. I just feel like I didn't really do a ton of work to kind of like shop around. Like I had expected to. I kind of just went with the easier option, which was the recommended lender from the agent. And they ended
up
being fine.
What were you expecting to have to do?
Well, I was expecting to have to like come up with a pre-approval like before I even started like working with the agent. And that's kind of what everybody had explained to me beforehand, was to get your lender and your financing set up so that you, once you go to the agent, like you're basically presenting an easy job for them to take up. But like the agent, what ended up happening was I reached out to the agent first, then he immediately hooked me up with the lender and they seemed fine to me. So it wasn't really anything wrong, I would say, with the lender. I just would have probably liked to shop around a little bit more. And at the end of the day, like I didn't really interact with them that much. It was mostly just, you know, here's a few forms for you to fill out here, like hook up your bank account information. And then like the rest is kind of taken care of. And I will say like I used, so it was Veterans United was the one I used, which to me seems like a pretty like straightforward lender. I don't think there's anything too, like, I don't think there's anything wrong with them, but yeah, it was definitely like kind of just like, I wasn't expecting to get approved so easily. I would say like, I feel like the approval process was kind of a little bit wishy-washy. It was kind of just like, oh, like under your income, like boom, you're instantly approved for like way more than you need, you know what I mean? And that's kind of the scary
right,
part, I
yeah.
feel like, especially for a lot of like new people. It's like, oh wow, the bank says I'm approved for like $600,000, like guess I need to start shopping for $600,000 houses. But I would say definitely like real, like do the budgeting and beforehand and actually understand like the mortgage amount that you're signing up for, because like I feel like there's a lot of people who kind of fall into this trap with the mortgage approval limits. So yeah, that's the kind of like the lending piece. And like I said, the agent,
let me jump in real quick, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead
if you don't mind. It's just I'm dying to know, because I sort of like disclosing a little bit, you know, the process of buying a house with between my wife and I. We have tension about that. I go in and saying, this is how much we need to spend per month, and that should be our budget. And she's like, but we can afford this. Did you and Emma go into it on the same page? Was there any disagreements that came up when you saw like how easily and for how much you were approved?
Yeah, I would say so. Like, it's definitely, I would say our situation might be a little bit hard to relate to, just because like we're very much, it's very easy. Like we're very on the same page, like all the time. And my wife is very frugal. She does not like spending money. So she's actually more of the camp of like, why are we spending this much when we could only spend this much and still have this, like,
okay,
the same square footage or whatever. So it's a little bit of a, you know, it's always like a conversation, just like anything with marriage. Like you have a conversation with your spouse and kind of work out what you need to, what you're really trying to get out of something. For us, like the requirements were pretty simple. It's we needed a yard because we wanted a dog, and we needed a place that wasn't like a piece of crap, basically. So as long as those requirements were met, we were pretty comfortable with anything. Oh, and just to also, as long as it wasn't a bad area. That's like, especially in this area, mm-hmm. the Norfolk Hampton Roads area, there's a lot of like patches that are really rough. And so as long as we weren't in any of those bad spots, it was all going to be fine. And I think that's like kind of like a lot of trust as well. Like you have to kind of trust your partner to know what they're doing. Like, just like I said, like playing on strengths, like she appreciates that my strength is like doing all this research and handling the numbers side of things. So she trusts me to take care of that. And then she can, you know, focus on stuff that she's good at. Like, for example, she's really good at all like the fine details and all the like, oh, how are we going to like move our furniture? How are we going to get our furniture that we want for our new house? Because we have a way more square footage in this new place. Like we got a budget for our furniture as well and all the decorating. And like, what about the fence? The fence looks like it needs to be replaced. We need to get the fence replaced and budget for that. Stuff that like I might not necessarily be thinking of in terms of like ROI, right? But she's like kind of there in the background being like, oh no, we should really also look at this. So it's kind of like, it's a really, like, it's a balancing act, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I hear from this story about how you and your wife have these complementary strengths and how you work together and balance each other out. Like, I just hear like the makings of a super team, right? I'm picturing like 5 or 10 years from now, you guys are making some real power moves because you are so in sync and compatible, and you also can combine your efforts. I mean, that's really cool to hear. It sounds like things were just destined, right? You know, like you said, you met in high school, and it's just sort of like always been meant to be. You guys are, sound great for each other.
Yeah, it's so definitely like I said, I mean, I feel like a lot of people in my generation, it's kind of hard to relate to our relationship because, like I said, we've been together since high school. Most people don't really make it past college. But I will say, like, if you can, if you find somebody that's like good for you, like, definitely do make an effort. Like, it's not perfect. It's never going to be perfect. But you have to kind of accept that, like, you know, you can sort of take the good parts and the bad and still love them, like, all the same. And, like, I will say it on the, like, the backside of it, it's so nice being married. Like, people in my generation, I feel like, don't really appreciate the value of having two people in one household. Everybody's just kind of like loners and they're all just like, you know, rent, paying rent and cleaning their house and, you know, doing the dishes and cooking, doing everything all together. Like, that's a lot. Like, I feel like it's a lot even sharing it between the two of us. So having the both of us together, like working as a team, it feels like a superpower, honestly. I just wanted to throw that out there.
Well, I thank you for that because as part of the service and wealth kind of mission or theme or message that we try to get out there, it also has to do with family relationships and taking care of that. You know, one of the things that really inspired me to try to create this brand and this channel is throughout my career, just the number of stressed and failed relationships. And so much of those came back to one of two things. One was immaturity and not recognizing that relationships are work. And when you put in the investment, it's going to be one of the best ROIs you could get of, you know, we're not talking dollars and cents. We're talking about even better than that in terms of, like you said, a superpower. And the other was finances. And all too often those things crossed, you know, and you had not just relationships that were ruined and people who were hurt, but in the military, you know, we're all part of a team. And when a member of your team is, you know, failing at home, it affects everybody. It affects the mission readiness of the team, of the unit, the morale of those around you. And so when you can offer that kind of mentorship and vision that you just shared, to me, that's just as important as talking about your experience of working with different agents and coming up with a strategy. So thank you for that. I did kind of jump in and cut you off on the initial line of conversation there about working with different folks on the team. And I feel like you were just about to kind of transition to talking about the agent and connecting with the general contractor. Do you want to go back and continue on with your line of thought there?
Yeah, for sure. So Once I found the agent that I was set on working with, I already kind of had a strategy sort of planned out. And so the first house that we went to go to, he like started asking me about like Earl loans and like if I wanted to maybe do something like that. And I was like, all right, we're going to be a good fit together. Like, this guy's already like four steps ahead of me trying to like plan out this deal, right? So I would say having that strong agent who's been around, who knows the business, knows the people in the area is definitely a very strong asset to have. I feel like people, especially like investors, kind of have an adversarial relationship with agents sometimes because it's like, you know, they're taking a cut out of your pie sometimes. And it's like, you know, investors are very numbers focused and they like to keep all of it to themselves. But I like the strength that the agent provides to the team. I think that's definitely valuable, especially when it comes to the network. Because like when I was initially starting to look for contractors to start doing some work to the house, I was shopping around, you know, trying to find stuff online, trying to like call like random trucks that I saw driving around, right? And nobody could match the guys that he had in his back pocket in terms of like price. So it was definitely valuable to have him for that reason as well. The contractor I did end up going with, I used for both. I had like an initial project was just basically like painting. And then later on, I had a project which was like more like actual rehab. And the same general contractor both times, he was pretty great to work with. We did have a couple of hiccups here and there, just like any business or relationship. Sometimes things don't go according to plan, but you know, we were able to kind of adapt and kind of work together through the problems, which I feel like was a good experience to have.
Yeah, most definitely. You'd probably be done a disservice if the first one went perfectly smoothly and everything went A-okay, because then as soon as you come across any sort of friction points later, you might be tempted just to say, well, this person's not going to work out, or there's something wrong with this contractor. It's just part of the game. Now, when you talk about you had mentioned, sorry, got a little tangled up my thoughts there, so I'm going to start again. So you mentioned that you kind of like had this instant bonding moment when they mentioned like IRL loans. For those who don't know who are listening, what's an IRL?
I will explain it, but I encourage whoever's listening to actually go out and look it up themselves, just in case I explain it r incorrectly. But if my memory serves right, it's the in interest rate reduction loan available for VA loans. And it's basically, I don't know the requirements on it, but after a certain point, you can basically, it's like a streamlined refinance. You basically refinance at a lower rate. And I think you keep the same lender as well. It's kind of just a very straightforward process. There's like minimal closing costs, I think, is the real benefit. And so that's kind of like a strategy for people who are more concerned about interest rates. Because like at the time when I was shopping for a house, it was the interest rates were all, everybody was all doom and gloom about the interest rates. I think they're fine personally, but everybody was kind of like freaking out. So I think he was trying to sort of encourage me a little bit by saying like, oh, you know, there's a potential that you could like do this streamlined like refinance later on if you don't like your interest rate. So yeah, that's kind of like one of those things that kind of stuck out to me when we first started talking. The other thing that stuck out to me when we showed this house that I'm sitting in right now, the first thing he walked in, he was like, oh man, like it smells like money in here. It was smelled like smoke. There was smoke damage everywhere. He was like, this place stinks. But he was walking around and he was like looking at the listing. And I guess it was a relatively newer agent. Maybe only has like a few deals under their belt. So they were you know, somebody that he didn't really recognize. But he like as soon as he saw the house, he was like, oh yeah, I could body this agent. Like I could really take this guy for all he's worth. So that when I heard that, I was like, sounds good to me.
There you go. That's a good sign, right? Like somebody who's confident and knows what they're looking for and how to work with people. The reason why I asked you about the IRL, and great job explaining it, especially because what you did is you talked about the reasons why it's a good deal for those of us in uniform and who have eligibility for the VA loan. But I also wanted to use it as an opportunity to kind of like introduce the fact that the VA loan is more than just that one-time purchase. You have the ability to cash out refinance. You have the ability to refinance at a lower interest rate. Hold on, I got to take a time out. Dagny, can you please give me the room? Okay. No, like I'm busy. That's why the door was closed. Okay. Thank you. I'll see you in a little bit. Okay. I'll see you in a bit. Yeah. Okay. Bye. All right. We'll just restart that. I saw like this little head, like she was like super stealthy coming in, and there's like a little head like bobbing.
Yeah, no worries. No worries.
Okay. So anyway, there'll be some splicing in there. But when it comes to the VA loan, there's other options available that make it really, you know, attractive and flexible for those in uniform. Similar to the IRL is VA loans are assumable. And so maybe out there, you know, didn't get the chance to highlight this. I hope the listeners were picking up on it, but you talked about being intentional of saying, let's go to this duty station because the barriers to entry on the real estate market are low enough that we can do what we want to do. Well, at some point, you're not going to have control and you might find yourself in San Diego. There's a very good chance that there's somebody in uniform or a veteran out there who purchased a house in that market maybe 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, maybe longer, when interest rates were like 2%. And you can literally assume their loan and take that interest rate from them, so long as you have your eligibility. So the VA loan has all these different flexible options that really, I mean, if you don't take advantage of them, you're leaving money on the table. You know, kind of like the agent and the contractor, when they saw the property, they're like, oh yeah, you're going to be really happy. There's money on the table here. Being in the military is probably one of the, if not the best opportunities to get started in real estate. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. The one thing I will comment on with the assumable loans is, at least based on my research, it seems like a little bit better in theory than in practice. The reason I say that is because oftentimes, like the person selling the house may not want to let you assume it, just because like their entitlement is kind of tied up with that. And if you assume it, you have to have the cash to. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you need to have the cash to cover what they have in terms of the equity already. So, in order to properly assume it, you have to basically pay them off the equity that they're owed, unless you could work out some other deal in that regard. But it is a little bit more complicated than just basically transferring from one person to another. There's kind of a lot of hoops that you have to jump through, which is why I wasn't really super focused on that when I was just getting started. But that being said, the VA loan on its own is already super valuable, especially that first time with a really low fee associated. That's definitely a very strong reason for like people who are in the military getting into real estate, is because we have this like basically just like a golden ticket essentially to get started. And it's definitely helped me a lot. I'm kind of having like the confidence to just jump in, especially with no down payment. I'm like, I ended up paying like $600 was my like total, like said and done, a cost for actually owning a house now, which is pretty crazy. Like nobody else can say that, except unless you're in the military.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we combine that with what you said earlier about as you studied real estate and you saw the ways that it can give you a higher overall internal rate of return through the different ways that you can generate wealth and generate income and equity as an investment, the fact that you can get into it for so little money down, it's almost a no-brainer. I feel like frustrated when I hear it doesn't just have to be young, you know, it can be, and this is, I won't say names, but there was a fellow instructor in the economics department a couple of years ago when I was there who was just on, I don't know if it was on principle, if it was like a bad experience in 2008, but they were just vehemently opposed to real estate as any sort of legitimate investing strategy. I tried to give him the numbers answer and you know, like get on the whiteboard and be like, okay, look, this is how, especially if you have like 5% down or zero down, like where else are you going to get a return like that? When you talk about your history, and this is a little bit of a jump back, you talked about getting into stock investing and being kind of focused on that and then learning about real estate. Did you abandon stocks? Did you like cash out to try to like position yourself to be in real estate? Are you like solely focused on real estate, or are you still investing in stocks? Are you still, and I assume when you talk about that, we're not talking about like a IRA or the thrift savings plan, but actually like a brokerage and where you're investing for yourself, you know, pre-retirement. Is that still part of your investment strategy and what you're doing with your money? Are you guys like just all in on real estate?
Yeah, so before I answer that, I will say, like, to your point about sort of the real estate downers, everybody who like online or people you talk to, like there's people who try real estate all the time, like, but that's all they're really doing. They're just kind of trying it out. I feel like those people who kind of like accidentally fall into this real estate investing camp really have a bad experience with it oftentimes. And you know, it kind of leaves a bad taste in their mouth, and they kind of share that with everybody else to kind of warn them. And it's they're trying to they're it's in, I feel like it's good-hearted, like they're just trying to help you out because they don't want you to mess up. But I feel like it's definitely something you have to be intentional about. I always tell people like who I teach about this stuff, I tell them all the time, like, yeah, you need to be intentional about this. You need to treat real estate like the business that it is, and not like just some sort of side hustle that you can just kind of like fall into. But I will say, like, if you are intentional about it, it definitely does have like very real benefits. And I always like kind of like showing people like the theoretical like infinite return, because like if you think about it, you put 0% down, zero money out of pocket. If you negotiate it well with your seller, then theoretically you have infinite return, right? Obviously, it's not like that in practice because you have to live there for a year. But like the numbers don't lie. If you have 0% down, like, you know, any money that you make is free money, basically.
Yeah. the numbers don't lie, right? It's maybe you don't like math. Maybe, well, not you, but maybe someone out there listening is not a big fan of math, but like you got to learn a little bit and the numbers will tell you the truth.
Right. Yeah. So as far as stocks go, I definitely do still invest in stocks. There was a time earlier this year when I was considering liquidating all my stocks in order to buy more real estate because like I said, like the numbers just are so appealing. And I've already got this one under my belt, so I'm like hungry for another one. But I understand now that there's like a lot of value to having both. So I still invest pretty heavily into stocks. About 15% of my income goes into stocks every month. And that's been paying off really well recently, obviously. The stock market's been going crazy. But that's like, obviously that feels good, but even when it's down, I think I'll still keep investing in stocks just because like I believe in the long-term investing mindset. I would say instead of switching between them, I'm now kind of heavily invested in both. Just because like when I say that there's benefit in having both, I mean like when you, particularly when you go to a lender and they see like, yeah, you've got like all this stuff in real estate, but if you also have a strong asset base in stocks, like it's very like good for you because it shows that you're a diversified individual and that you don't have all your eggs in one basket. And so it's super easy for them to want to work with you because they're like, okay, this person's got like a good income and they've got all these assets and they're diversified. Like this is a no-brainer if we want to work with them. So that's kind of something that I'm kind of starting to think like long-term, like this, I need to have both. And also like, it's nice to have that stocks where that I can kind of pull from that in smaller increments when I'm like later on, if I need to support myself from my investments, it's a lot harder to sell a house than it is to sell a position on a stock. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I do about 15% of stocks. I'm focused on just building up a lot of cash for my next real estate move, but I still definitely invest heavily into stocks.
Let's take a minute here and talk a little bit about the strategy, if you don't mind sharing how this kind of overlaps, right? Because we're talking about stocks and this opportunity to withdraw from that brokerage account in the future. Obviously, we're not talking about retirement. I'm assuming you're also using the thrift savings plan to save towards retirement. Talk a little bit about how beyond just simple like diversification of assets and exposure to different risk classes, but like how you see in your lifetime, real estate, stocks, and retirement savings kind of like working together to help you achieve and afford the life that you want to create for you and your family.
Yeah. So the one thing I will say is TSP, I actually don't invest anything in TSP right now. And a lot of people kind of think I'm crazy because I'm into investing, but I'm not investing in TSP. The reason I say that is because the TSP, the match that they give you is great. But they only actually match you after 2 years in. I didn't realize that at first. So what if you actually read like the actual outline of the TSP, after 60 days, the government will automatically give you 1%. That 1% goes into a traditional account, which like, you know, I'm a Roth guy. So I hear traditional, I'm like, oh, great. So that automatically goes in traditional. You can't change it to Roth. And then after 2 years of service, they will start matching an additional 4% if you contribute 5%. So right now I'm not doing that because for one, I don't necessarily like the TSP's funds. I like the idea of them for, especially for people who aren't as educated and who are just kind of doing this on the side because their employer tells them it's a good idea, but it's very like simplified. It's very like vanilla. Like you have one index fund, that's it. I like to shop around a little bit more. I like to do a little bit more research. And so that's kind of why I don't like enjoy the TSP as much. But after 2 years, I definitely will be doing that just to get that free 4% from the government. But yeah, so that's kind of TSP. Long term, like you said, I can't pull from my retirement accounts. Well, I can, but that's not necessarily something I want to plan for. So I do have retirement and just like a regular brokerage account. My retirement account, I max out to get that nice tax advantaged investment. And then I put about, so it's like $600 a month into my retirement account, and then about like 750 in my like regular brokerage. So it's about even. I'm a little bit more heavily into the regular brokerage. And so, yeah, basically my plan is to build up as much real estate as I can, all the while keeping the stocks steady, because I can, the stocks are pretty, the one thing I like about stocks the most is that they're super easy to plan for. If you just accept like the average, even if you're like more conservative, like you can take a percent or two off the average and still like kind of plan that out, but you can just do a compound interest curve and plan it out for 40, 50, 100 years, and kind of get a reasonable expectation for what you're going to have. So I like that aspect, and I will be using that as kind of like my safety net. If the real estate doesn't kind of get me to where I need to get to, where I need to be. So that's kind of the plan, is to have my individual broker or my regular brokerage account ready to withdraw from, like when I'm, you know, 45 or whatever the case may be, and have my retirement account set up as kind of just like a nice extra, I guess, payday when I'm when I turn 60, to kind of like really boost me up. And then obviously any real estate that I get up to that point will just be kind of like income that I'm getting continuously.
Okay. Yeah, that's great. And thank you for some of those additional comments, because it is, you know, if we're talking about the TSP as one of the, there's a lot of selling points out there that are sort of half truths, as you kind of alluded to. And, you know, one of those, or at least they're like not always applicable. Yeah, as you pointed out, that 5% doesn't kick in until you've been fully vested, which means you survived 24 months and a day in the military. And obviously the reason for that is if for some reason you don't work out, and there are plenty of folks who we see all the time who are, you know, I think there's plenty of names that you can call them, but they just don't work out in the military. And you wouldn't want to, the military wouldn't want to give them that matching money and have them walk away. So if you're really trying to kind of follow what Max is doing, and a lot of it is what we talk about here on the channel and what we talk about in our upcoming book, The Ultimate Military Retirement Plan, is that thrift savings plan or the retirement account, it's sort of like that way in the future backstop. And there's, in that case, you don't want to put all your eggs in that basket, because if you do, you're just kind of signing up to be grinding until you're 60. And you've already identified that, and you've seen, hey, if I'm just maxing out my TSP contribution, I personally would say an even greater sin is maxing out the TSP and an IRA. And at that point, you're like basically broke for the next 40 years, in the exchange that in your 60s, you'll, I don't know, live on a yacht. But you're being balanced. You're being conservative. You're covering sort of all of the different baskets, and you're doing that in your first year in uniform. And all too often, the objection comes in like, I don't make enough. Like, there's no way I could possibly do that. And, you know, you've already pointed out the fact that your wife works, and that really helps out with the finances as a household. But if you were single and you were getting your O-1 base pay and your BAH there in Norfolk, would you still be able to do these budgeting things and saving for cash, saving into your Roth IRA and saving into your brokerage account?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, that's something that I kind of have been trying to convince my sailors of lately, because just for the record, I know one of my sailors is a E4 and with like 6 years in, and they make more money than I do. So just want to throw that out there. Like, everybody kind of like thinks like, oh, like you're an officer. Like, I just can't relate. Like, there's just no way I could ever do that. So I feel like people kind of don't really appreciate the fact that not only do they get paid relatively the same, but you also have a lot more years ahead of me to kind of get that head start. And then obviously the officer pay scale increases a lot higher at a much higher rate. So that's kind of like where the trade-off is there. But like I said, like for the four years that I was at college, like these people are making money. I recently saw a projection that kind of like outlined like the first like 8 years of an enlisted person's pay. However, they like, if they were aggressive about it, they could have like $250,000 in 8 years. So it's definitely possible. And I will say, like, on the dual income side of things, like it's definitely I just want to be clear, like it's absolutely helpful. It's not easy doing it on a single income, but it's not impossible. I would have just had to basically cut back a little bit and kind of take things a little bit slower. But I mean, if you're only planning for your own financial situation, your expenses are going to be lower. So that's kind of the benefit. And also, like, frankly, if I was by myself, I'd probably be doing like even more aggressive strategies, like living in a basement while I like rent out like 2 units or something crazy like that. And just kind of like, you know, it kind of depends on the person. It depends on what you're comfortable with. But anybody's situation, no matter what, like, as long as you don't fall into some crazy trap of like maxing out all your credit cards and not paying them for 5 months, like as long as you like kind of follow the basic like path laid out to you like by the military kind of helps you along in this in that sense. But like most people will be able to do this easily, and that's just like I like to educate people in my command as much as possible. But it's hard, especially like when you take into fact like into account the life side of things. Like there's a lot of stuff that people have got to pay for, and they don't really get a choice. It's not as easy as just like cutting it off your budget 1 month. Like sometimes you just gotta have that expense. So like I feel like sometimes people, when they first start getting into this, they get kind of like shell shock, and they start feeling like bad about themselves and about their situation. They feel like they're falling behind and there's nothing they can do about it. But if you take those like first few steps, like especially with budgeting, like that's such a valuable skill that I feel like so many people are so bad at, but it's so easy. Like all you have to do, like I try to explain to people all the time, like it's addition and subtraction. Like if you can do that on a monthly basis, like you're already ahead of like most people in your age group. And once you kind of figure that out, you can start to see like, oh, I actually have some money left over at the end of the month, even if it's $100, even if it's $200. Like that's still some money that I could start saving. And once I have savings, what am I going to do? Well, now I can start investing it. Kind of like working your way up from the beginning, even if you feel like you're, you know, it's too late for you. I just feel like that's not true.
No, it's, I agree. It's never too late. You know, one of the things that is, I think, really important to talk about. And again, I want to kind of point out and congratulate you or say thank you for the effort that you put into sharing what you've learned with your sailors. Because as you relayed earlier, when I didn't have to actually ask you for your money story, but you talked about growing up and not ever really having, you know, that exposure to this is investing and this is wealth management and all this different stuff. You had a very responsible and frugal mother, and even if she didn't teach you how to budget, you probably had that role model to look back at. And not everybody comes from that background, and they end up making some really big mistakes. But there's almost nothing you can't bounce back from. And it comes down to those little daily activities that open the door to the bigger life-changing investments. And one of the things that I just think is worth highlighting here is when you talk about budgeting is not just connecting all your accounts to an app, right? Like, then at the end of the month, your app flashes red and said, oh, you spent an extra $200 in restaurants. Like, that doesn't help. And what Max is talking about here is, and you alluded to it earlier when talking about deciding how much to spend on a house, you went in ahead of time. You're proactive, and you said, how much am I going to make? How much do I want to spend? How much do I need to save? And you kind of set up some limits. Beyond that, are there any other techniques or tools that you're using with that? Like, I assume you're doing automatic transfers to this account or that account. Do you use any sort of tracking apps? Do you do everything by hand? What are your methods?
So I kind of try a little bit of everything. I have, like you said, automatic transfers going into a regular checking and savings accounts to kind of like separate the buckets. I like the buckets mindset. I think you actually taught me it like initially, and then I kind of like started adapting it to my personal situation. But like, you know, having your main bucket where all your bills get paid, like your mortgage or whatever, and then like kind of stuff overflows, like that maybe isn't as important. And then at the end of the day, you're kind of left with like your fun money, whatever you want to call it. That kind of is really helpful, I think, for people, especially when, you know, you kind of join the military, you start getting a paycheck, and whether you want to or not, all of a sudden you've got bills to pay and you don't really understand where they're all coming from. Like you just kind of sign up for things here and there, and then all of a sudden you've got all these bills and it's kind of hard to keep track of them. So like having everything kind of set aside already kind of gives a lot of people a peace of mind, because then they have one number in their bank account that they can look at and be like, oh, this is how much I can spend. For me, I've been a spreadsheet guy for a long time. I very much enjoy like the simulation aspect of it, and like actually planning out my own like formulas, and like kind of like I like actually kind of breaking it down and understanding how like something affects my overall budget, especially with the investments, kind of like projecting ROIs and doing all that stuff, like all those calculations. I like to actually understand how that works, because a lot of times like you'll find all these calculators online that you just type numbers into, and like some magically it turns into an answer for you and you don't really understand how you got to that point. It kind of helps your confidence to like understand the steps that it takes to get there. And then I have tried some apps here and there.
Sorry.
Look.
Yes, that is awesome, girl. Be careful. I'm gonna put on my Jasper hat later and come track you down, throw you in the kennel. Okay. It's priceless, right? So
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
I
it's
hope you
Halloween,
remembered
man.
where you were in your train of thought.
Yeah. So budgeting apps, I have tried a couple. None of them really seem to give me the outcome that I want. I've heard Monarch is good. I haven't tried that one personally, just because it's got a subscription fee. Just like most people who are into, saving money, like I don't really like spending stuff on things that I don't have to. So I'll probably just keep sticking to the spreadsheets, because that's been what's been working. But if I wanted something more automated, that might be a possibility. To me, it's kind of, I don't like when a program really like overly simplifies things. Like to me, if it's something like particularly when you're troubleshooting, like say there's a problem in your budget, like you say you're saving this much, but at the end of the month, like you're still negative. Like what's happening? It's a lot easier for me to go into my spreadsheet and just kind of like see all the individual line items and categories and be like, okay, this is where it's going wrong. Whereas like those apps might just tell you like, oh yeah, you're spending too much on like restaurants, when like in reality, like you might be spending too much on something else that's kind of just like overflowing into these categories. I don't know. That's kind of like my two cents on that. And then like the spending tracking, I do a little bit here and there, and that's like I literally go into my statements and I'll like categorize each expense. I don't do that often because it's really time consuming and it's really boring, but it does help once in a while to kind of like look back at the last like 3 months and just kind of like note like maybe there was like something really crazy that happened that like might be leading to like my low savings amount. Like for example, this past summer, like there was a lot of stuff going on with our cars or vehicles, had to get a lot of inspections, a lot of like replacement parts and stuff. So it was kind of like, I was like, dang, like my savings hasn't been growing as fast as I wanted it to. Like, what's going on? And then I looked back and I was like, oh yeah, it's because I had to spend $100 here, $100 there. Like all this stuff kind of adds up, but you don't really think about it in the moment unless you actually like go back and track that. So yeah, I like to, I don't really like to kind of get too into the weeds with like the budgeting, like software side of things. Like I like the basic like napkin math, like, this is how much you get as a paycheck. This is how much your major bills are. And then aside from that, like this is all what you have left to spend on all this little side stuff here and there. I feel like that kind of simplicity helps a lot of people more than like any app would. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And the reality is that when you do it that way, you're really attuned to where your money is and where it's going. And if you're allowing an app to do it, it can be a lot easier to stick your head in the sand like an ostrich or to just not be aware. And I especially like what you said about being able to, and again, this is one thing that I would share from the way I did is I started out very much like you. And eventually, like you just have that intuition that grows, and you only get there because you're familiar. And like now, I don't need to look every month. Like I already know that, we spend like $464 a month on insurance policies. Like I just know where the money goes, and it gives me that peace of mind. And when I hear you talk about it, I have a suspicion that some people might think, you know, I don't have time for it. It sounds too difficult. I don't like spreadsheets. But as you just explained, like you can get out a piece of paper or a napkin and just write it down. It's all about being familiar. Are there any tips that you have that you would give? And let's just assume that we're talking to someone who is not so comfortable with spreadsheets and naturally likes to get in the weeds. I know you said you didn't like to, but obviously if you have spreadsheets, you're in the weeds a little bit. But any tips that you have for somebody that could help, who maybe has like a little bit of an allergy towards budgeting that might help them get started and get comfortable with it?
Yeah, no, I just want to be clear. Like I actually love getting in the weeds. Like personally, that is super fulfilling to me. But obviously I know that that's pretty unique. I don't think a lot of people enjoy spreadsheets. So that's why I say like, I don't really like diving into it too much, especially when I'm explaining it to people who are just kind of getting started, because it's very overwhelming.
Okay, I understand. Yeah. Okay.
But like, so when I'm kind of teaching people the basics of budgeting, something that really helps, I think, is to, first of all, break it down to a monthly basis, keep everything consistent. I know we get two paychecks a month. A lot of people kind of like get hung up on that. I try to like convince them that it's actually just one paycheck every month, because that makes it simpler from a math perspective, because most of your bills are on a monthly basis. So basically, you know, you get your paycheck every month. Thankfully, in the military, like we have the best job in the world from a financial standpoint, because it's so consistent. You could plot out how much you're going to make 20 years from now. And that's really something that's pretty unique in this modern job climate. Like most people don't know if they're going to get laid off next month, let alone what they're going to be making 5 years from now. So it's definitely helpful to have that just as a baseline. Like this is how much money you're going to be making. We know that for a fact. So once you have that number, basically after that, you have to deduct all of your recurring monthly expenses. And that's really basic, just like your rent, if you have rent, your subscriptions, your car payment. I also like to break like insurance down into a monthly cost, even though for most people it's like a semi-annually or annually expense, just so you already have it set aside. So you're not like down $1,000 one month for just for a car insurance payment that you weren't expecting. So you have that all, like all that recurring stuff that's very consistent and plannable. Like for example, like your Wi-Fi payment, I guarantee you your Wi-Fi payment is probably going to be the exact same amount every single month, unless you're on like some flexible plan or whatever, right? But like that sort of thing is very easy to plan for. And so if you can deduct all those from your total, then you kind of get into the things where it's a little bit more flexible, but still consistent. And what I mean by that is primarily like your food budget. The food aspect can be a little bit of a hang up for a lot of people, especially some of my junior enlisted folks, because they, you know, they don't really always have the best kitchen set up wherever they're staying. So it's really hard for them to meal plan. And on top of that, like their time commitment might, especially if they're single, it might not allow them to be cooking all the time. So that's definitely a hard conversation to have, especially because it's so easy to just go out and buy like a $10, you know, chicken sandwich from a fast food restaurant. But I kind of try to convince them that like, okay, every chicken sandwich that you get, if you get one of those every single day, like that's going to add up to this much at the end of the month. And that's kind of an eye opener. Anyway, I kind of digress, but basically you want to kind of get a rough estimate for how much you're going to spend on food, and then kind of add a little bit of a buffer, because like obviously it's not going to be consistent. It's kind of fluctuate a little bit depending on the month. Once you have that kind of lined out, then the rest is really a lot more flexible. Then you're starting to get into stuff like, okay, how much do I spend on like video games every month? How much do I spend like going out with friends every month? How much, you know, how much do I want to set aside for alcohol? That kind of stuff is where you can really start to play with it. Like the more consistent expenses, like you just got to pay them. Like you don't really get a choice, right? But like the ones down there is really where you make your money, where you can kind of be like, okay, do I really need all this in my life? Does it really adding enough value where I can justify spending hundreds of dollars on this every month? That sort of thing really helps a lot for people to kind of break it down into that like smaller chunk where like, okay, this is what you actually control every month.
Yeah, that's really good. And it really, you know, if you kind of wrote that down as a, you know, 10 steps or 10 tips, it'd be really easy for somebody to follow. One of the things I like to add above all that is kind of what you were addressing at the end, which is figuring out what's important to you and what you value, and having that picture going in before you start budgeting, because it could be really difficult to you know, cut back on, you know, maybe like a what do they call it, Home Chef or something like that. I'm sorry, we don't have a lot of subscriptions, but you know, maybe it's really important to you that you have good sports nutrition. So Huel, I guess Huel would be one. And if you just had an app, or if you just sat down at your budget and you put Huel like into the subscriptions column, you might feel really guilty about what you're doing. You might get rid of that. But if you're really committed to a fitness lifestyle and putting the proper nutrition in your body, that's actually something important. You should give yourself permission to spend a little bit of money on that. And, you know, if on the flip side, you're saying like, I don't want to eat junk food, it's a whole lot easier to come up with a reason to put some money into buying some groceries and doing some meal prep on Sunday so you can skip those fried chicken sandwiches throughout the week. You know, one other thing that I wanted to add to this sort of like budget tips that I was thinking about as you talked about specifically the kind of subscription-based budgeting apps, I totally agree with you. It seems silly to me to pay for an app that then tells you you're spending too much on subscriptions. But if you're somebody out there listening and you are really battling your subscription addiction or, you know, purchasing things on through social media because you just can't help yourself, having that accountability of maybe like a higher level, more complex or sophisticated budgeting app or something that you're actually paying for to help you rein in your spending, it could actually be the accountability you need. And accountability is a big part of this. Do you and your wife sit down and do the budgeting together? Do you at least like kind of at the end of the month report and say like, hey, check it out, I accidentally spent, you know, an extra $500 on, you know, car seat covers? Not saying you would ever do that, but is there, do you guys have an accountability relationship there?
I would say to some extent it's really hard to kind of talk about our situation because I feel like it's just too easy. Like we don't really have to worry too much. Like we have a lot of trust in our relationship. So there's never really any concern that one of us is going to go out and spend $1,000 on some random thing a particular month. And I know that's not always the case. So I definitely appreciate that that's a very real concern for a lot of people. I think having accountability is important, particularly when there's not a ton of trust or perhaps degraded trust because of previous experiences. But for us, it's more of like a sort of like a, you know, like kind of a quarterly check-in. Like I kind of like do my expense tracking. I kind of look at what we've been spending our money on this past few months and kind of sort of think about if this is the direction we really want to be going. And then if it is, cool. If not, we can kind of change some things. Thankfully, because we're so frugal, we have a lot of flexibility in our budget. If something does need to change, it's usually pretty easy. But for a lot of people, that's hard, right? So I would say, especially with expense tracking, one last thing I would like to add is Amazon in particular is a really hard one to track. I recently found out that like you don't actually get a very detailed list of what you spend on each category. And so for us, we buy a lot of stuff on Amazon. It's just super easy. And I'm sure so many people do, right? It's one of the biggest marketplaces on the world, right? So if you go on the Amazon website, you can actually get a print off of like an Excel document of all your expenses, and they don't really give it to you in any other way. I think almost intentionally to kind of like trick you into like thinking that you're not spending as much as you are. But if you like add that all up, like it's really eye opening for a lot of people, especially because like I said, it's just so hidden, but seeing it all in that format is definitely very helpful. Sorry, that was just a side tangent I just wanted to throw in.
No, it's a great tip. And it's totally right, because obviously you have to realize that when you're going into trying to get control of your finances and put yourself on a budget so that you can start saving and investing for these big goals down the line, you're fighting against the marketing and the sales and the accounts receivable of all these big corporations that they don't care if you are behind on your bills, if you have $20,000 in credit card debt, if you're spending $600 a month on redundant subscriptions. That's just going to put their kids through college. That's going to buy them their next new car. That's going to buy them a boat or a helicopter. The more you spend, the better. And so that little hack of being able to go in there and kind of like get your downloadable file and find out what was this sort of like knee-jerk spending versus, oh, that was those were just our monthly, you know, resupplies for the household that we actually need. You know, that's an important little partition to make. You know, I think we could probably talk a lot about that, but there are a few questions that I want to make sure I ask you before we come to the end of our time today. And they may come across in no particular order. And if we don't get to all of them, we don't get to all of them. But
yeah, of course.
I realize I didn't ask earlier when you mentioned this nuke bonus that you got. I didn't ask you what you did with that money. Can you tell us how that broke down? You don't have to share dollar amounts if you don't want to.
That's fine. I'm sure it's all public anyway, right? Just like all of our paychecks. So it's a $30,000 bonus for nuclear officer accessions. And that after tax turns into about 22. And essentially what I did with that was I was kind of planning on using that for a real estate purchase. So in about half of it, I just put it straight into stocks. That's kind of what I do with all of my like large sum bonuses that I'm sure like everybody kind of gets them in the military. Like depending on what you do, you might get them at different times in your career, but like everybody kind of gets these bonuses here and there. So I usually just take all of that bonus and invest it straight away just because it's easy like for me to do that and not think about it. Whereas some people might just leave it in their bank account and then they might be tempted to spend it on stuff they don't need. And anyway, so tangent aside, basically I used about half of it for stocks. And then the other half I was kind of saving as sort of like a, you know, starting my career, not sure if I want to buy like how much furniture is going to cost, like how much I might need to buy, you know, for the next like 6 months or whatever. I'm kind of like a little safety savings, emergency savings a little bit. And then once we actually purchased our house, it basically turned into a renovation budget. And that's kind of like another benefit of the VA loan is that I never really had to worry about the down payment. So my savings basically just was already set up, ready to go for when I needed to do renovations, which I ended up deciding that that was a strategy I wanted to go with.
Okay. And then once you spent that money on the cash portion of that for the renovations, have you been saving back to build more cash back up from your regular paycheck?
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely like where we're at right now. There was a lot of like kind of extra cost. Just like any renovation project, there's like scope creep here and there. We ended up depleting almost all of our savings. We still had a few thousand left over at the end of the day. Kind of just now we're really like kind of working on rebuilding that savings emergency fund, just because like that's kind of like the foundation of all like investments. Like if you have like you need a savings, you need some sort of like cushion to manage the ebbs and flows of like expenses, like monthly spending. Otherwise, like your investments aren't really going to pan out how you want them to, because you know you say you're going to invest $1,000 a month, but then you have $1,000 like car fix that you need to take care of, and now you can't invest that $1,000 that month, and now you feel like crap because you like you're not following up on your goals. And so like having that fund, that emergency fund, is like foundational. And so that's kind of where we're at right now. And after that, like once we get our safety net kind of built back up, we're going to start basically just like using all those savings that we're putting towards emergency fund and just start moving it towards like a new real estate adventure.
Oh, that's great. Thanks. I'm glad you also broke that down into we had these savings and we need to make sure we always have those savings instead of just going straight away into the next project or investment. Based on the progress you've made and looking forward, do you have an idea of roughly how long it will be until you're ready to go round two with the real estate projects?
Yeah, I would say personally, it's probably going to be a year or two. I would obviously love to jump in as soon as possible, just because like I believe in the compounding interest effect. And like, you know, the more you do it in the beginning, the better it's going to pay off for you in the end. The only problem is obviously you can't just keep going all the time. You've got to slow down and kind of recuperate every once in a while. So that's kind of where we're at right now. We're just working on building that cash up. And then another thing, career-wise, I'm going to be going to nuke school here next year. So that's kind of like a little bit of a delay in a way, because like I could get a investment in Charleston, but the Charleston market is very, it's not very friendly to like newbie investors. It's very high stakes. All the houses are $500,000 plus. And so it's really hard to get into if I'm only going to be there for a year. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. I'm probably going to wait till after that to kind of make my next move. And that's even better because it'll give me more time to focus on building up my cash base and then start like doing more research on my next move, as well as kind of like just figuring out like how to be a landlord. Because as soon as I move out of here, I'm going to be renting it out for the first time and kind of like going through that process. So it'll be a good thing all in all.
Yeah, that's so I love two things about what you said. And the first is kind of working backwards there. There's a lot of steps out there. And if you overload yourself or you overextend yourself, you do stand a higher risk of running into some trouble. And, you know, that's my sense when I look back at different folks who I've worked with along the course of my career and who have, you know, maybe had negative things to say about real estate or even about the stock market is, or especially in crypto, right? But chances are they got in over their heads and tried to do too much too fast. And so you're being very deliberate, and you know, anybody who listens to what you're doing might think you're being aggressive. There's also this tone of being very conscientious and conservative about the risk that you're taking on. And so I think you've got a great balance. And the other thing that I kind of want to point out when we talk about these timelines, it's not just the money that compounds, it's the time that compounds. And first of all, wow, you know, to be able to be in this position of saying like, within your first 2 or 3 years in the military, you could already be onto your second investment property. I mean, that just, again, highlights what a great career this is to get started in real estate investing. But by the time you, you know, again, we're just simulating, right? Because we know this is not part of the T-Bolt family plan, but, you know, just simulating, if it's 3 years now, maybe it's 2.5 to the next one, then maybe it's every other year. And by the time you're 10 to 12 years into your military career, you can be doing this every year, because all of those properties that are now in your portfolio are bringing in rental income, and you're able to replenish that cash that much faster. And so it's not an exaggeration to say that within a 20-year military career, or even a shorter one, 10 to 15 years, through real estate, you could build a portfolio that would essentially get you financial freedom. And that kind of brings me to the next big question I wanted to ask you. Is you've already said that your life plans right now are don't include, or, you know, at least they're not anchored to this idea of like a 20-year career as a naval officer. And probably sometime before then you plan to ramp off. Have you set any sort of like financial criteria, like we need to have this much in terms of investments or this much income from our rentals or total passive income that's going to be a trigger for you to do that? Or is it more based on like, you know, just feeling in life, and like if you got to go and move on, you'll move on and let the investments catch up whenever they do?
So I have a financial answer, which is usually very clear and numbers based. And then there's like the family aspect, which, you know, kind of always throws a wrench in your plans, right? And so and in the best way possible, oftentimes. So I have a plan to be retired somewhere in my early 30s. And that's just based off a pure net worth standpoint. That's not based on necessarily an income standpoint. Obviously, it might be a little bit more fine-tuned the closer that I get to that point, but kind of, you know, I just kind of like to project a little bit and kind of have an idea of where I'm going to be at. And then kind of, if I'm not following that plan, see if I need to adjust some things in my calculations. But even if, you know, if everything's going well, then I can kind of refine it as I get closer to that point. And then along the way, you also have the life stuff that happens as well. And that kind of, you know, it's like the spice of life. You know, you gotta, you know, I might be having some kids here in the next few years that I've gotta sort of factor that in. And, you know, it's a very basic math equation. Like, it's always just how much you spend versus how much you you make. And if you can make that math work out, then yeah, you can absolutely accelerate your timeline dramatically.
Well, that's good. I'm glad that you gave that answer you did, because the reality is exactly what you just said, is life is going to be different in 3 or 5 years. And so, as we like to say in the military, you know, all plans fail at first contact, right? So it's great to have a plan going in, but also you want to be able to have the flexibility to adapt as you move through things.
Yeah.
You know, as we kind
of, that's like the, sorry, I would just say, like, that's like the real beauty of like the financial like aspect. Like, you want to have that flexibility. Because if you don't have the ability to roll with the punches, like, you're just going to be, you know, you can't get back up. And that's a really bad place to be in. So like, even if I don't necessarily, like, even if whoever's listening, they might not necessarily agree with the idea of like retiring early or, you know, sort of dropping the pack, if you will. But like, it's not necessarily always about that. It's more about the financial independence side of things and like kind of, you know, building yourself up as this individual who can do anything and like be flexible no matter what.
Yeah. And let's take a moment to just kind of go off of what you just said, in case there's, you know, the Secretary of War is listening or any of the generals in Quantico are listening. We're not trying to promote people getting out of the military for money reasons, just as much as we're not promoting the idea that you should stay in the military forever for financial reasons. And earlier you made this comment, and to the warrant officers, like, we all work with them, so we're not hating on you. But you just said warrant officer. It could be anyone. It could be that disgruntled 05, or it could be that bitter, you know, E6. A lot of different folks are still in the military because they failed to plan. And honestly, the entire military, from the small unit all the way up to the joint force, is a lot stronger when each of us is responsible for our financial situation. And if we each create for ourselves this ability to, as you said, have the financial independence or the financial freedom, if your passion is to serve, like, you can go ahead and stay in for the next 45 years, right? Like, just be a terminal E9 for 40 years because it's what you love, but you're there because you love it. And, you know, in your particular case, you were called to serve. You have a really, I hope, rewarding and challenging career path that you're on, but it's also not where you see yourself in 10 or 15 or 20 years. And you're going to give yourself the freedom to like pursue your passion and do what you want. And that to me is really what the community and the brand Service and Wealth is all about, is saying these are not things that are opposed. They go hand in hand. Let's not try to say like it's selfish to think about money or it's selfish to try to create wealth when you're supposed to be here for selfless reasons. It's just part of a balanced life and part of the whole.
Yeah, I will say, like, just on the military side of things, like, if you, to me, the best leaders are the ones who are there because they like being there. You know, nobody wants, like, everybody knows them, and nobody wants to work for the people who are just there to collect a paycheck because they never put on senior chief and they've been in the Navy for 20 plus years and they're just kind of waiting till they've been in for like 19 years and they're just waiting for that last year to retire, right? And they're, you know, nobody wants to work with them because they're always like, you know, doing the bare minimum. They don't really care about their sailors. They don't really care about their job. They're just kind of there to the finish line because they have to. I feel like that's, you know, that's kind of like something that's a little bit hard to deal with in the military, is people like that, especially in leadership positions. So it's beneficial to all of us to better ourselves financially so that we don't turn into that. Because the best leaders I've ever had are the people who love doing it, who are there just because they want to be there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I totally agree. Same experience. It's a shame that we can't say it's getting better. I wish you could say like, everybody's here because they want to be here. But as a shameless plug and self-promotion, you know, if you find yourself kind of stuck in that trap of being like, I'm in the service, I can't get out because I don't have the cash or I don't have the investments or the wealth to help me be financially independent, go on Amazon, search for Service and Wealth, and you'll find my book. Go ahead and buy it. I just revised it. I added over 100 pages of new content, and it's now got 12 money habits that will help you get control of your finances and come up with a way to create that financial independence so you can, you know, go do what you want to do and not be trapped at 19 years, just trying to collect a paycheck and wait it out. So like I said, a little selfish plug there. Before we wrap up today, I wanted to kind of, as our conclusion, give you the chance, just totally free form, to reflect on not just the past year, but, you know, or even beyond the past 5 years since you first put on a military uniform, go into the Naval Academy, and give you the chance to answer none or all three of these. One, is there anything looking back financially that you wished you hadn't done? Two, let me ask all three. Okay. Cause then you could choose in case one's a dumb question, you could just skip it. So the second question is, looking back, is there one thing that you did that you think was really important and that you would recommend to, you know, anybody else to do? And then the third thing is, what's one sort of recommendation that you have for somebody who is curious or motivated to follow in your footsteps down this path into getting into real estate, you know, a book or a mentor? So one thing that you would recommend that they could do to help them get started. Hope that's not too much.
I think I can articulate this. So I'll say, as far as things that I wish I hadn't done, really, like, you know, it's easy to say now that I don't really regret anything, but like there definitely were times where I was like, oh man, this sucks. But you kind of have to roll with the punches, and kind of, you know, get back up again. Cause, the only person on your team from a financial point of view is yourself, and you gotta keep yourself going when you get those things that just kind of knock you down. So yeah, I would say the piece of advice I have is just like, you know, try to educate yourself, because that was the biggest thing for me that really kind of gave me the confidence. And probably if people are watching this, they have already started on that journey. But like, you know, there's such a hurdle when people are first getting into it to, you know, they see the numbers side of things and they're like, oh, I'm not good at math, I can't do this. Or they see, you know, real estate investing and they're like, oh, that's too much work, I don't have the time for that. But like, even just like the foundational stuff, like building a budget, keep getting control of your finances, like that's so powerful to an individual to have control over their financial situation. I see it so many times in my job, just like people who come to me for advice and they just have like really no idea what's going on with their financial situation. And they feel like they're losing control of their life because of it. And it's just so sad that like, our world these days just revolves so heavily around money and how much money you make and how much money you spend. And there's so many vices that people get into that can really sap you of all of your worth. And so kind of like starting that journey and starting to become conscious of your financial situation and gaining control over it is super powerful to anybody. And I recommend very highly that you start getting into it if you haven't already.
No, thank you for that. It makes me think of an analogy that goes back to my days in college before I was in the military and had to do with training. And my teammate had told me, he's like, you have to put a foot on every rung of the ladder. It gives me a flashback also to being a young second lieutenant aboard the USS Wasp. And we were all trying to be high speed and go up and down the ladders on the ship. And we're all falling. And it was because we were skipping those steps. And I think your response, what you just said, that's so important, is you're not going to be able to go straight away from, I'm in debt, I don't know how much money I have in savings, I don't know how much I'm spending each month, to suddenly creating a real estate empire or building a six-figure brokerage account. You got to have brilliance in the basics. You know, it's no different than a training in the military. Brilliance in the basics, learn the small stuff first, crawl, walk, run, and it'll work itself out. But if you skip those foundational things, it can all come crashing down.
Yeah, and never feel like you don't have enough money to get started too. I kind of skipped over this, but I was making $125 a month as a first year midshipman, and I was investing $100 a month for my first year. So never feel like you have no money to work with. Even a small bit just to get started helps so much to start learning.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, there's a price of admission, you know, and how much better it would be to, none of us can predict the future, right? But we've all seen the headlines that talk about you know, the AI bubble is going to pop in the stock market. It's a lot better if you only have like 500 invested and it goes down by half than if you have, you know, 500,000 and it goes down by half. You know, as we wrap up here, I want to give you the floor just to kind of share any final thoughts you have, or, you know, if your round's complete, that's great as well.
I feel like I said my piece. Already. I know this is pretty long, but thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate, obviously, your mentorship over the years. And yeah, I hope that maybe us talking together might convince one person to start sort of self-educating and kind of getting themselves on the right path.
That's my hope too. And it comes down to one person at a time. Thank you, Max, so much for your time today. And it was really a pleasure catching up and chatting. And all the things that we covered today, I find to be really useful. You know, things you offered different perspectives on some of the things that I think and that I've been doing. So that's just proof that when you use the word mentorship, it's not just from the older or the seniors down. It's across and it's above, and we all have a role in helping each other out. And that would be sort of my final comment to the audience is, once you make the leap into investing and real estate in particular, you're just going to find that like success seeks out success and it breeds success. And like everybody's trying to do well out there and help each other out. And so don't let any sort of anxiety about that hold you back. Now, if you did listen, you know, listening to this, if you did find value in this, like we would love it if you would to find some person in your life, whether it's a subordinate, you know, sailor, marine, soldier, airman, space guardian, who you think could benefit as well, and share this podcast with them. Or it could just be sharing it with your partner back at home, or your best friend, maybe even your family. And again, the value that we really have here is if we can add one more person to the community every week, together we'll be a bigger and stronger military community. So thanks again. I think it's a great place to wind things up for this week. And until next time, thank you, and we'll see you.
Thank you for spending time with me today. I know how busy life is in and around the military, and I don't take your attention or your time for granted. It really means a lot to me that you're here, and that's why I pour so much of myself into each episode to make sure it's worth your time. If today's episode helped you, here's your challenge. Share it with a teammate, battle buddy, spouse, friend, partner, or someone in your family who could use this information. Together, we're growing a stronger, smarter, and wealthier military community. One listener at a time. For more resources, tools, or to sign up for a free coaching session, head over to www.militarywealthcoach.com. And you can also find us on LinkedIn and Facebook by just searching for Military Wealth Coach. Follow us on Instagram and X at MWC112358. Our groundbreaking book, Service and Wealth, 12 Proven Money Habits to Master Military Finance, has just been revised and expanded for 2025, and it's available in paperback and Kindle on Amazon right now. And stay tuned for our upcoming release of our next book, The Ultimate Military Retirement Plan, Your Standard Operating Procedure to Financial Freedom. Hey, until next time, stay financially fit and mission ready.